Hello, everyone. My name is Stefan Alexander. I'm a professor in physics here, and it's a great honor to actually have our favorite president, President Chris Paxton, introduce our speaker, Dr. Katie Freese. But before Katie, the president comes up, there's a gift that Katie, has given to the president, is going to give to the president through me. This is her book. It's called, what is it, Katie? That's right. Thank you, Katie. The Cosmic Cocktail. So, without further ado, Chris Paxton.
Thank you for the book. I'm looking forward to reading it. Good evening, everybody, and welcome to Brown University. We are having a funny microphone issue.
Could be me.
No, just make it a little bit calmer.
And that's the technical term.
Yeah. How's that? That's good. That's good. So again, good evening and welcome to Brown. We are delighted to be hosting this year's New England Cosmology, Gravity, and Dark Matter Workshop. And it's really great to see faculty and students from several institutions in the region to come together and talk about issues and advance our collective knowledge in this area. Tonight, I have the pleasure of introducing our speaker, Katherine Freese, one of the world's preeminent theoretical astrophysicists, who will speak about the dark side of the universe. I guess that was the first slide that we already skipped. And she's currently the George E. Uhlenbeck Professor of Physics at the University of Michigan and a visiting professor at Stockholm University. Her pathway to the exploration of dark matter and the mysteries of the cosmos began with a summer course she took at the age of 15, in which she studied Einstein and his theory of relativity. Her interest in the topic led her to major in physics at Princeton, one of the first women to do so there in the late 1970s. And then she went on to earn a master's degree at Columbia and a PhD from the University of Chicago, where she was the recipient of the William Rainey Harper Award Fellowship. Now, I have been told that she brings both a determined nature and an optimistic outlook to what she has described as the, quote, longest outstanding unsolved problem in modern physics. She's collaborated with top physicists both here and abroad in hopes of identifying the dark energy that permeates the universe and has posited the existence of dark stars that may have formed immediately after the Big Bang. Her work relates not only to the past and present of the universe, but also to the question of how its composition will evolve into the future. Between 2014 and 2016, Dr. Freese served as director of the Nordic Institute for Theoretical Physics based in Stockholm. She was awarded an honorary doctorate from the University of Stockholm and a Simons Foundation Fellowship in 2012, and she is a fellow of the American Physics Society. So her book, The Cosmic Cocktail, Three Parts Dark Matter, which I'm going to tell you about even though I haven't read it yet, was published in 2014 and combined her views on the universe with her experience as a woman scientist. She's made several appearances in popular media and a broadly targeted scientific gatherings, including the TV show Through the Wormhole with Morgan Freeman on the Science Channel, on BBC TV and radio, at the World Science Festival, and at the Isaac Asimov debate at the Museum of Natural History in New York. So as a teacher, first at MIT and now at Michigan, she's keen to convey the compelling nature of scientific discovery to her students as she provides them with guidance on their research and career aspirations. I could list you a very, very long number of global science organizations and advisory councils on which she served, but I won't. I'll only say that her service to the profession has been exemplary. I've also been told that although her professional accomplishments are impressive, She finds time to be an outstanding water polo player and an avid dancer. Is that right? Good.
Well, I retired from water polo.
Okay, no water polo, still dancing. So anyway, we're really fortunate to have such a distinguished scholar and excellent role model for future scientists with us this evening. So I want to please ask you to please join me in welcoming Dr. Catherine Freese. Thank you.
I can't. Thank you.
So your level?
1, 2, 3.
Everybody here?
Yeah.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, great.
Do you want the lights down a little, or is this good?
I don't know. You tell me. Do you want the lights down a little bit, or is this good?
No, front down.
These right here. Okay, I think that's good. Maybe that's too much, I think. Let me bring it back up a little. Well, I'm jet lagged. I don't need any further encouragement today. I actually just flew in from Stockholm yesterday, and so I really am jet lagged. And this is a picture of me in on either side of me is Nordita, the Nordic Institute for Theoretical Physics that I directed. And behind me is the Stockholm University where I work now half the year with the many students and postdocs. And I just thought I would tell you that the Nordita, it's a joke. I'm telling you about the Nordita buildings. So they were, back in the day, hospital buildings on the outskirts of Stockholm. In fact, they were for infectious diseases. So the building that I was in was leprosy. There's also typhus and typhoid, and I guess I'm blessed because I was in the one that is cured by antibiotics, which, by the way, I was also on last week, but not for leprosy. But anyway, so I want to turn now to the big picture of the universe, the origins of modern cosmology. So to put into context what we have achieved in the last 100 years, let's go back through human history when people wanted to understand our place in the universe, our origins, and what the universe is made of, and all these big questions. People had creation myths. Every culture had a different creation myth. And the remarkable thing is, starting 100 years ago, with the work of Albert Einstein, we have a creation myth that's called the Big Bang, and guess what? It's right. So we have really the incredible advances that we've made in the field of cosmology in the last 100 years is just absolutely stunning. So it all started with Einstein with his theories of relativity in 1915, and soon after he wrote down his equations, other people applied them to the universe as a whole, and then gave rise to the possibility that the universe could be expanding, it could be static, it could be contracting, a lot of different ideas about what it could be doing. But before I continue along this vein, I wanted to contrast that with observational cosmology at the same time, which was absolutely primitive from the point of view that scientists thought that every bright object in the sky, everything that we see out there, people thought that was inside the Milky Way. And then they started to question, well, wait a minute, are there island universes? Is there something out there? So at the time of Einstein's theoretical work, that was not known. It's really quite remarkable. So in fact, there was in the 1700s a man named Messier who was interested in comets. So he cataloged a bunch of cloudy objects, nebulae, that were in front of the comets that he found very irritating. And we now know these as a catalog of galaxies. So for example, the neighboring big galaxy Andromeda, that's M31. So this is kind of astonishing to think that he was onto something that he had no idea. But so backing up now to this question about applying Einstein's equations to the universe, at the time there were many possibilities for what the evolution of the universe could be, but Einstein had a favorite. He loved the idea of a static universe because that's additional symmetry in that the universe would look the same at all times. But nature trumps your most elegant theories, and along came Edwin Hubble, who used the telescopes above Pasadena and Mount Wilson Observatory to make some major, major contributions. So one of them was that he realized that some of the objects that he was looking at were simply too far away to be inside the Milky Way. So he was able to prove that there were galaxies besides our own. So that's step number one. And then step number two, looking again at those galaxies, he realized that when he looked at atomic light coming from those galaxies, well, and we know the wavelength of the light when it's emitted, and so the wavelength is the length of the wave, the distance between one peak and the next. But then you measure it here on Earth, and that wavelength had been stretched. So for example, if you drew a wave on top of a balloon, and you blow up the balloon, that wave gets stretched. So that's exactly what he saw, and the implication was that the universe must be expanding. And well, that's what it does. So, and Einstein at that point had to abandon the idea of the static universe. So indeed, wherever you are in the universe, you'll see things moving apart, everything moving apart from everything else. Now, that's certainly not true in this room, so we're not feeling this Hubble expansion because our local gravity is too strong for that. And even we have neighboring galaxies that are being drawn together. But if you look at large enough scales on the average, things are moving apart from one another in this expanding universe. So when we say the Big Bang, what we mean is that the universe started out as a primordial soup, and it started about 14 billion years ago. And in this primordial soup, you had all kinds of particles that were really tightly packed together, right on top of each other. And so don't worry about what they are, but the basic idea is you had all this tightly packed stuff, particles interacting constantly. But then as time went on, the universe expanded and it cooled off. So things started moving farther and farther apart from one another. So that's what the Big Bang, the hot Big Bang is. It's a universe, oh, thank you. It's a universe that is expanding and cooling off from the beginning. We can draw the raisin bread model of this. So I am told, being the great chef that I am, I haven't tried it, that if you take a piece of raisin bread and you put it in the oven, the dough expands. Well, that's an analogy for our universe, in that if we think of these raisins as galaxies that are spread around in the universe, well, they're moving apart from one another, not because they're doing anything, but simply because the underlying space is expanding. So that's the kind of analogy that's meant in this model. But there's one really big difference between raisin bread and our universe, and that is the fact that the raisin bread has a central point. But we don't think that our universe does. We don't think there's any special point in the universe. So first of all, the Earth is not special, but nor is the solar system special, nor is the Milky Way special. So if I went back to this earlier picture, then, and let's say we're at the center here and we observe galaxies moving away from us. If you went to some different place in the universe, you'd see exactly the same thing. From the point of some other galaxy, from that point of view, again, everything else would be moving away from you. So I wanted to talk about this notion of the Big Bang because I think it's sometimes misleading in the way that it's presented in the popular press. Let's do the opposite. Let's start from where we are now and then go backwards in time, where everything gets compressed closer and closer together as we inch towards the Big Bang. And in that case, what happens is that everything in this room would crunch to one point. But what if the universe is infinite, which is very possible, and then you bring everything in closer and closer? Sure, that if things are getting denser and denser, but there's still something out at infinity. So an infinite universe, if you go far enough back in time, was also an infinite universe. So the starting point there was not an explosion from a single point. It's more that we go back far enough in time that we don't understand how to explain the physics anymore. We don't know how to unify quantum mechanics and gravity, and so we're kind of stuck. That's what happened 14 billion years ago. So if you're going to draw a Big Bang, which is Well, if you want to have an explosion, which is really not the right way to look at it, then please put one at every single point in the universe. Now, there's a variant of this, which is called inflationary cosmology, and the inventor just walked in, Alan Guth. So in this giant universe, there was a period called inflation, where the universe was accelerating, very, very rapid expansion. So again, it's not an explosion, but perhaps that is the modern variant of the Big Bang. So I want to turn now to the subject of my talk today, which is the question of what is the universe made of? So if we take all the objects in our daily experience, we take our body, the air that we're breathing, the walls in the room, all the stars and planets and everything that you know about, all of that is made of atoms. But all of that atomic material only adds up to 5% of the universe. 5%. Well, that leaves us 95% that we don't understand. So in fact, if I drew a pie chart of the universe, you'd have 5% of ordinary stuff, the stuff that's in our daily experience. Then you'd have about a quarter dark matter and about 70% dark energy. And so this dark side makes up almost the entire content of the universe. And that's what we're trying to understand. We want to know what these things are. So I'd say if you're going to have a cosmic cocktail made of 10 ounces, then here would be the ingredients. You'd have, well, more like 2.5 ounces of dark matter, if I'm rounding up, 7 ounces of dark energy. Then you'd have some ordinary stuff. And I wanted to mention here also, you'd have a millionth of an ounce of supermassive black holes. And part of why I'm raising this subject is because people tend to confuse dark matter and black holes, but please don't do that. Black holes may be an ingredient in the dark matter, but they also may not be. So this question of what makes up the dark matter is a separate question from these supermassive black holes in the universe. Now, if I go back to the hot early universe, all of this stuff was interacting with everything, so I'd say that was shaken, not stirred. So I want to start with this question of how do we know dark matter's there? How do we know what galaxies look like? And this problem actually dates back to the 1930s. So it wasn't until I got to Sweden that I learned about this man, Knut Lundmark, in 1930, who was one of the first people to notice this. He wasn't popular, so they shipped him out of Stockholm to Lund, he was kind of forgotten. But ironically, Lund is a great place to do particle physics nowadays. But anyhow, so and famously, Fritz Zwicky in 1933, this is Zwicky, was also using these same telescopes in California above Pasadena. And he looked at the Coma cluster of galaxies, which many, many galaxies inside there, and he noticed that some of them were moving too rapidly based on the amount of material that he did know about. If you look at the other stellar light, then why are these things moving so fast? It didn't make sense. And so he postulated that the existence of some new material, dunkle materie in German, which would be the explanation, dunkle materie meaning dark matter. So if you have additional matter in there, then it's pulling on things, it's speeding it up. Gravitational pull speeds up these orbits. And by the word dark, it just simply means it's not stars, it doesn't shine, it's actually dark. And I will tell a story about him. So in his book, he described his colleagues as spherical bastards, because no matter what direction you look at them from, they're still bastards. So I have to say, I'm glad I wasn't his graduate student. He was a brilliant guy. He had a lot of amazing ideas. The stuff he invented is amazing. But anyway, so then this question started in the 30s. It persisted, and a lot of credit goes in the 1970s to Vera Rubin, who with her collaborator Kent Ford looked again at, in this case, of galaxies, and saw the same kind of thing. So again, that things were moving really, really fast in every single galaxy that she looked at. And at that point, the scientific consensus really became confirmed that dark matter had to be there, not just in one weird cluster of galaxies, but in every single galaxy. Oh, back, I really have to tell you this, about Fritz Zwicky. So I was doing a radio show called Coast to Coast Radio, which is pretty much, oh, it goes from 2 to 5 a.m. on if you're on the East Coast, and they actually shut me down at 4 because I was falling asleep. But I still have a couple hours before that happens. But anyway, so it's mostly truckers who are interested in UFOs, but you get some interesting people calling in. So someone called in named Barbarella. So I said, hello, Barbarella. And it turns out it's Barbarella Zwicky, the daughter of Fritz Zwicky. And apparently he was quite bitter that people didn't listen to him about the dark matter problem. And she's writing a book about that. And I said to her, well, we're listening now. So let me tell you about the work of Rubin and Ford. And so what they did was look at rotation curves of galaxies. And the way I'm going to explain that is not I'm going to leave the subject of dark matter, and I'm going to turn instead to the solar system, because it's a really useful analogy for this question. All right, so let's look at the solar system. And what I've plotted here, this is the only equation in my talk, but is you start out at the sun and you move to the right as you're moving farther and farther away, the radius of the orbits as I move away from the sun. Or as I move up here, it's the speeds of the planets. So I start out with the fastest one is Mercury. Wait, then it's Venus, right? Okay. Earth, Mars, da-da-da-da. And in making this plot, I was meant to remove Pluto, you know, but I accidentally added a planet 9, I guess. So I'm happy to announce I've got 10 planets in there. Oops, it's fun, so I left it. But anyhow, so what you see here is that the speeds are determined by two things. The farther away you are from the sun, the slower you move, but also depends on the mass of the sun. That's this big, is that me? I guess so, obviously. So that big M is the mass of the sun. So for example, if the sun weighed four times as much, then everything would be moving twice as fast. So Tycho Brahe was on the observational side, a man who made the studies of these planetary orbits. And he lost his nose in a duel, and after that wore a gold and silver replacement. He also, well, there was some question about how he died. So I always heard that he died at a dinner with the king, because you're not supposed to get up before the king does, and he had a lot of wine. So his bladder burst and he died 3 days later. Now I can attest to this. I was invited to join the Nobel Prize dinner last year in Stockholm, and I dared to go to the ladies' room. And when I came back, I was chastised, and I'm thinking, what the hell with it? I'm not dying of a burst bladder. I couldn't believe, I was like, are you kidding? Anyway, so I now understand how that might have happened back in the 1500s. But so there was a competing theory, which was mercury poisoning, and that his student, Johannes Kepler, might have poisoned him, and those Kepler's laws maybe should have been Brahe's laws. So they actually dug up his body. They exhumed his body in Copenhagen and tested his mustache hairs for mercury poisoning. I'm not kidding. This was like 10 years ago. And the answer is no, there's no mercury poisoning. So we're back to the burst bladder. Okay, so that was my analogy with the solar system. But now let me go back to galaxies and look at the same thing. I'm going to look at the orbits of things as they move around the center of the galaxy instead of the planets around the sun. So here you have the same thing, that the speeds here are determined not just by the mass in the middle, but throughout this, inside this circle. All of the mass inside that circle pulls on stuff and speeds it up. So what Vera Rubin and Kent Ford did was measure these speeds. So this is the same kind of picture I had before. You start out at the center of the galaxy and move out in radius. And as you move up here, things are moving more rapidly. So based on the stellar light inside a galaxy, this is what you'd expect. Just like the planets, things should move more slowly as you move farther away from the center. But instead, you have this what's called a flat rotation curve. Things are still moving pretty fast as you move out. And so what happens is, in addition to this component that was already known, if you add in the dark matter, then ka-ching, then it explains these rapid motions. So let me show you a picture of the Milky Way to give you an idea how this works. So here we are in the Milky Way. At the center, there's a supermassive black hole. It weighs about 4 million times as much as the sun. It's shown in yellow because that way you can see it in this picture. And as you move out along these spiral arms of structure, that's where the stars are. And so if the sun, for example, is out here. And so when you look out into the night sky and you see the stars, that's what you're looking at. But if we take it on the side and look at it, here it is. So we call this the disk. It's a flattened thing that, and for example, the sun is out here at 25,000 light years away from the center, and no, we're not feeling the effects of that central black hole. We're not being pulled in or anything like that. Okay, so that's the stellar light, but, this is just a pretty NASA picture, but so that's the stellar light, but here's this disk. It's this flat thing. It's tiny. Most of the mass is in this giant spherical thing that we call a halo. Actually, I don't know the origin of that name, that term, why it's called a halo, but it's this giant spherical thing. That's where most of the mass of the galaxy is, and that's with lots of dark matter. So that was the first piece of evidence that we're missing something, that dark matter should be there. The second piece of evidence, this is also came from, it's Einstein's work, and I think Zwicky also was proposing we use this to look for dark matter. Basically, where any wherever there's mass, that mass will bend light. So it doesn't matter what this is. It's some kind of dark matter. I put a massive compact halo object, but it doesn't matter. This mass will take the light from a star, and although the mass itself is dark, it doesn't produce light of its own, but it affects the light behind it big time. So it bends the light, but it could also bend it in the other direction. So if you didn't know better, you might think, aha, the star is actually there, but you'd be wrong because the light's been bent. But then you might notice, wait a minute, I've got two images of the same thing, and you'd notice, it's sheared. So you look for multiple images that are sheared. And by doing that, by looking at this background stuff, you can figure out what the mass is en route between the light and you. Okay, here's my graduate student getting more and more lensed. So there's an app on your iPhone, it's called gravitational lensing or something, that was created by a Michigan graduate student and has the correct equations in there so you can lens yourself. So here's some data from Hubble Space Telescope of lensing. And there are there's a lot of lensing going on in here. I can't remember everything that's going on, but you can see that there are multiple sheared images of some background light. And by studying how that background light is imaged, you can reconstruct the dark matter in between that light and you. And computer reconstructions can be done, and I'm showing you one here. This is not from the same object, but it's the same idea. It's also from Hubble Space Telescope. This is a computer reconstruction of the mass in between the distant light and you. And so in this case, you see this is a cluster with lots and lots of galaxies in the peaks. But look at that, there's also more dark matter in between the galaxies. So the galaxies have dark matter, the clusters have more dark matter. So this stuff is really everywhere. There's another classic example that people talk about for dark matter. This is called the Bullitt cluster. Here we think that it's called the Bullitt cluster because this is supposed to look like a bullet. So here we think that there were two clusters of galaxies that are in the process of merging with each other. But the first thing that happens is that as they collide, well, you've got, on the one hand, you've got the gas that gives off X-rays. That's the stuff in pink. That stuff gets stuck when you have a collision. So if you and I collide, we're going to get stuck. We're not going to go right through each other. On the other hand, there's some other stuff that's shown in blue that's also discovered via lensing. So there's additional material that's not getting stuck. It keeps going. That's the dark matter. So this is an important object because what you're seeing is a split between the way ordinary matter behaves, ordinary gas behaves, and this other stuff, the dark matter behaves. So that's a nice confirmation that you've got really two different types of mass in the way it's behaving. So I've talked about many ways that we know that this dark matter problem exists, from things moving too quickly, gravitational lensing, Bullitt cluster. I wanted to mention one more. This is kind of amazing that we actually would not be able to exist without dark matter because galaxies wouldn't have formed yet. You need dark matter to speed up that whole process. So dark matter is most of the mass in the universe, and it drives the clumping of mass also from the beginning. So initially, everything was pretty much spread out evenly. And what I'm going to show you is a few slides from a computer simulation of how you had dark matter particles, which are shown in blue here. And they, as time goes on, the dark matter clumps together. The ordinary matter can't clump as easily, because when it tries to do that, well, it's talking to photons and particles of light, and those particles of light stream out. So they sort of destroy the galaxies, the proto-galaxies you're trying to form. But dark matter doesn't do that. It doesn't talk to light. It doesn't give off light. It doesn't feel it at all. So it can clump. Later on, the ordinary atoms can follow along with these proto-objects that were initially started by the dark matter. Okay, so we start out at an early point in the universe with the dark matter particles more or less spread out uniformly. It's actually inflationary cosmology that tells us exactly what they're doing, because if they're not exactly spread out uniformly, there's some regions have a little more mass than their neighbors, and those regions tend to accumulate more mass, more, and lead to galaxies. And so let's watch that happen. I just have a few slides where you can watch the dark matter start to clump together. The bright stuff here is supposed to be the dark matter. And then today, you end up with, from these computer simulations, with something that looks like this. You have these long strands or filaments of structure, and it's at the nodes of these things. That's where the galaxies are. And this is a pretty good match to what our universe looks like, actually. So again, we wouldn't be able to exist unless dark matter had jump-started this process, and then atoms kind of go along with the ride and make galaxies. Okay, so let's go back to this pie picture, and I want to address this question. Okay, so dark matter, well, we think it's there. There's a million pieces of evidence for it. What is it? So the first thing you might try is gas, rocks, cooled into some kind of snowballs of hydrogen. And unfortunately, all those things, they were the first things to get ruled out. They would give all kinds of observational signatures that haven't been seen. So early on, there was a disagreement between the people who thought, well, it could be massive compact halo objects. And these are things that would be sort of some. Let me go on to the next slide and show what they are. They would be faint stars. Okay, so maybe our telescopes hadn't seen the bright stars. But what if you had a lot of faint stars, or you had kind of planetary objects that never lit up, and so on? So that was a possibility. Or what if, well, when stars run out of nuclear fuel, they collapse to being very dense white dwarfs, neutron stars. And so these were possibilities. And all of these were lumped together under the category massive compact halo objects, or MACHOs. And I participated in on both sides of this debate that I'm about to tell you about. And we concluded that none of these things are going to solve this dark matter problem. It's still possible that 15% of the galaxy might be made of white dwarfs. But all these other guys, this is at the order of a few percent. So there's not a lot of faint stars out there. So back on this debate, there were people who were asking this question, could it be faint stars and so on, which would be made of ordinary material? But it was, on the other hand, people said, well, it can't be. It has to be something exotic, because we know there are these limits to the amount of atoms. And so there are other exotic particle candidates that people were talking about. So there was the battle between the MACHOs and the WIMPs. Okay, so atomic dark matter is not enough. And I don't think I need to add anything to this slide. I'm about to tell you a lot more about WIMPs, so hold on that point. But the current thinking is that the best bet is that the dark matter is some new kind of elementary particle, new in the sense of not yet discovered. Okay, so as far as what the dark matter could be, there are many, many candidates. And I'm not going to have time to talk about all of them. I did want to say that the obvious one that would have been so great would be neutrinos, because we do know neutrinos exist. Unfortunately, it was clear pretty early on that wouldn't work, because they're really light and they would stream out of galaxies and destroy them, so that wasn't going to work. And then last year, the Nobel Prize was actually given for the mass of the neutrino. So neutrinos are very, very light. they only contribute 0.5% towards the budget, the mass budget of the universe. But there's another proposal, sterile neutrinos. These are not the normal neutrinos. They're a little bit different, and so it's still possible that these guys could be the dark matter. And there's some observational evidence for tentative signals, but very controversial. I also wanted to mention some very interesting work being done by Stefan Alexander on superfluid dark matter, in particular with fermions, and so you have to talk to him about that. Stefan, our host here today. And I'm not going to talk about these other ones. My focus today is going to be on the first one on the list, these WIMPs. So I want to tell you first what they are, and then I want to tell you why I think they're very good candidates for the dark matter. All right, so WIMP stands for weakly interacting massive particles. Okay, I want to talk about what does weakly interacting mean? Well, there would be billions of these going through your body every second, but you're not feeling it. They're not doing anything to you. And the reason for that is, well, we already know that they're not giving off light. They don't have electromagnetic forces. They also don't have strong nuclear forces. I think I have to stay away from that. So yes, they feel gravity. Well, there are four fundamental forces, and so you can ask the question, okay, so other than these three, what about the weak force? This is the weak nuclear force is responsible for some types of radioactivity, and I can postulate, what if the particles have that interaction? And that's what I mean when I say weakly interacting. And on the massive side, what we mean is that they weigh 1 to 1,000 times as much as protons. The reason that we think these are good candidates, well, there's two reasons for that. And one of them is known as the WIMP miracle. A lot of these particles are their own antimatter. And so in the early universe, when there were lots of them flying around with each other, colliding with each other, because they're their own antimatter, they would annihilate whenever they collided. And annihilate means they would turn into something else. They would lose their original nature and turn into something else. But as the universe expanded, then they wouldn't find each other anymore, and the annihilation would stop. And then you can ask, if that annihilation process was through this weak force, how many would be left today? And the answer comes out just the right abundance to explain the dark matter. So that coincidence is compelling. You're of all the four forces, you're using the one. This is kind of a sensible thing to try, and then you get the right answer for the abundance of dark matter. Then the second reason that they're good, that people think they're good candidates, is because they're automatically predicted by theories that were proposed for completely different reasons. So they're killing two birds with one stone. In particle physics, there's a lot of unresolved problems, and in the course of trying to resolve those problems, you automatically get WIMPs. An example of that are supersymmetry, an important extension of the standard model of particle physics. So we take the standard particles, and for every single one, you get a new partner. So if you've heard of quarks, then every one of those quarks would get a new partner, and it has a twiddle over the top. That's how you know it's a supersymmetric partner. All of these new particles, they're heavier than our ordinary stuff, which is why we haven't seen them. And the heavier ones, decay to ever lighter ones until you get to the very lightest supersymmetric particle, and that thing is stable. So the lightest one of these, that could be a very good candidate for WIMPs. Oh, I think I'll skip that. So we have good reasons to like WIMPs as dark matter candidates, but now the question is that right or not? And so people have been looking for them. And there's a three-pronged approach to doing that. So I've got the same diagram drawn in three different directions, and I want to talk about these three different approaches to looking for these particles. So let me start over here with producing these particles at the Large Hadron Collider at CERN in Geneva. Here you have this giant collider, which is 17 miles around, and you've got proton beams traveling in opposing directions. They collide at four different intersection points where you put your detectors. And so this is nice skiing up here, by the way. There's a view out the window too, it's not bad. And I just thought I'd show some pictures of the LHC because they're kind of cool. And so this, by the way, is Fabiola Giannotti. She was the leader of one of these detectors, and now she's the director overall of the CERN laboratory in Geneva. Here's a picture of this ATLAS detector that she was one of the leaders of the experiment, and you can see there's a guy standing there, just how giant these things are. It really takes thousands and thousands of physicists and technicians to make this operate. It's really a beautiful thing. The other one, the other major detector is the CMS detector, and here at Brown there's a CMS group that was working on this experiment, and there has been one major success at the LHC, and that is the discovery of the Higgs boson, the last missing piece of our standard model of particle physics. So this is an actual collision. It's obviously reconstructed with a computer where you had proton coming in from the left hitting a proton coming in from the right, and so it turns into something which, and then that, and there's concentric cylinders of arrays of detectors picking up all these different pieces of along this decay chain, and the final piece were photons, particles of light, that are illustrated by these green beams. So by taking what you measure, all these pieces you measure, and reconstructing what happened, they were able to show that there was a Higgs boson, this missing particle, that was discovered. And that it weighed, here it is, there's a bump here at around 125 times the mass of a proton. And so this was the first major discovery by the Large Hadron Collider, but it immediately led to a Nobel Prize within half a year or so, I guess a year. But and there's Peter Higgs and François Englert. I wanted to say these particles, the Higgs particle, is not going to explain the dark matter. It only lives 10 to the minus 22 seconds, and our universe is 14 billion years old. But that's not going to cut it. So now that the Large Hadron Collider has now been taking data with double its previous energy, and one of its major goals is to look for supersymmetry, look for dark matter, but it hasn't found it. So what you would look for, again, is in these proton collisions, you'd have a chain of these new particles created until, at the end, you'd have the dark matter, which would escape detection. And you'd be able to reconstruct the whole story and prove that you'd discovered these things. So we have here at Brown, we have Gigi Fan working on the theory of this kind of thing. Even if you did discover that, you still haven't proved that you've explained something that really lives as long as the age of the universe. So we needed to have a complementary astrophysics approach to look for these things. And that leads me to underground laboratory experiments, where here you're taking advantage of the fact you've got billions of these things going through your body every second. Well, yeah, so let's stick a detector here and wait till you're hit by one of these things. Not so easy. These interactions are rare. Only if of these things going through your body, one a month is going to hit one of your nuclei. So these experiments, they're rare, there's not much energy deposited, so you have this scatter off of your nucleus and you have to detect that. Less than one count per kilogram per day, very low energy deposit, very difficult experiments. That leads me to how I got into the subject of dark matter. I was in Jerusalem and it was New Year's, and this man knew where to go to party. So Andrzej Drukie, he's Polish. He speaks English, French, German, Polish, all at the same time. He's gotten better, okay? He's gotten a lot better. He's a brilliant guy, and he told me about his work with Leo Sadowski on ideas for neutrino detection. And so this is the picture of Andrzej, and this is a picture of Leo. And what they neutrinos also are weakly interacting particles that scatter off of nuclei. And so they wrote this paper proposing that, but the count rates were too low, it was never going to happen. And then Goodman and Witten said, well, but WIMPs are more massive, it's going to be easier. And so they wrote the first paper on that. And then the three of us, and we've got David Spergel here in the front row, so we wrote the next paper on the subject where we put in the WIMPs. Oh, you've got to be kidding me. The speaker's not, okay, good. The better shop. Anyway, so we put in the WIMPs that are in the galaxy, did that properly. So David put that in, and I calculated a bunch of Feynman diagrams for what should happen. And And so what we realized is, okay, this is, we told experimentalists, hey, this is this something you can do? And they decided they could. So they started building experiments. You have to go deep underground to do these experiments. We are flooded right now with cosmic rays. They do have electromagnetic forces. They do, they actually are dangerous. They do cause cancer when you're up in airplanes or whatever, or living in Aspen is not so good, I don't know. But I would take it anyway. But anyhow, so you have to go deep underground, and this is in South Dakota. This is back when the mine was empty. Now it's got the Lux experiment down in there, led by Brown's Rick Gaitskell. So here it is. You have to go underneath the Black Hills of South Dakota. And that's just an example of all of these underground mines. That was a gold mine, but there's also, you can go under mountains, under mines, and so on. It's now a worldwide effort to look for these things, even at the South Pole. Okay, so there are claims of WIMP detection, and the question is, are any of them right? So I wanted to tell you about the one, this is very strange, and the reason that it's based on this paper that Andre and David and I wrote, which is, this is an experiment in the Gran Sasso Tunnel under the Apennine Mountains near Rome. So frankly, I think I'd rather be near Rome than underneath deep down in a mine in South Dakota, but. So the basic idea here is that, well, the sun moves around the center of the galaxy. So I'm being the sun. And so WIMPs are coming at me, and it's kind of like when you're driving and the rain looks like it's coming at you. So we call this the WIMP wind. And on top of that, you've got the Earth moving around the sun, which means that the relative speed between us and the WIMPs changes with the time of year, and you'd expect a larger count rate in June than you would in December. So you'd expect the signal to go up and down with the time of year. And guess what? That's what this DAMA experiment sees. Over 10 cycles, they see it exactly right. Very, very strange situation. So they're obviously seeing something modulating, but the question is it WIMPs or not? And there's two issues with this. One is that they won't let anybody look at their data, which engender suspicion, but on the other hand, every criticism that's been leveled to them, they have actually dealt with properly, and there is no alternative explanation that anybody can think of. So it's very strange. The other factor that's I just have to show this slide. These are leaders of the different experiments. This is one, Kolyar, the Kojin experiment. Here's Rita Bernabe, the leader of this experiment that has this signal. Eleanor Prelay, the leader of the Xenon experiment, and this is a quote that Juan gave me. I'm a Spaniard caught between two Italian women. You've got some pretty strong personalities in this business. So the weird thing is although DAMA is seeing signal, these other experiments are not. And in particular, the strongest experiment not seeing anything is the Lux experiment led by Rick Gaitskell here at Brown. So they have, so you have to go deep underground in the mine that I showed you. And these experiments are made of xenon. The DAMA experiment was made of sodium and iodine. And I'm not going to really try to explain this slide, but just to say that this is different for different masses of these particles and how strongly they're interacting. If you want to explain DAMA, you'd have to be in these orange regions. But according to Lux, you have to be below this purple region. That looks like it's not working. Looks like it should be ruled out. So this is a very strange situation. On the other hand, this experiment is made of sodium and iodine, and this experiment is made of xenon. So is it really fair to... So we don't know how to plot them on the same plot. In this particular example, we've assumed a particular type of interaction to allow us to plot them here. But in reality, it's apples and oranges, and it's weird. So we can't throw this out unless we go and test it somewhere else. So that's, a few pictures of. So for students interested in going into physics, please be aware we have a lot of fun. Okay, so this is at the UCLA Dark Matter meeting. This is some of us. And this is Rick at the Baja Cantina. And let me tell you something. We have this meeting every other year in UCLA. Rick said, we're never going to top this one. So I'm not going to tell you what happened to the latest one. It was pretty good. Anyway. Okay, so to test Dhamma, you have to build an experiment made of the same material and go in the southern hemisphere. Then you can get rid of whatever's going on up here. And so there's three groups that are going to do that. And so in the next 5 years, 3 to 5 years, we may know. You're either going to see it again or you're not. So this test is coming. I think it's very important. So one of the experiments, DM mice, I just like to show this because the U.S. of course has to maintain a presence at the South Pole. You can attack anybody from down there, right? So but it's also a very good place to do experiments. Very dry. It's really really is excellent. And so here's the ice at the South Pole. And as you go down, there's these strings of detectors that are mostly being used to look for neutrinos, but also. Oh, and by the way, there's the Eiffel Tower, just for size comparison, but also there's some dark matter detectors that are piggybacking off of these neutrino experiments. As a theorist, I don't go there, I get postcards. So I also wanted to mention some more new crazy ideas that we had with André Druckier and oh wait, how come I don't have the list of authors here? Well, David is also on this one, I don't know what happened. But so the basic idea here is that you have a nanometer thin plane of gold, and as the WIMP comes along, it knocks the gold nucleus forward into hanging strands of DNA. So yes, you're using DNA for these detectors. So no, the WIMP is not breaking your DNA, but gold can. Okay, so you have these rapidly moving gold particles that break the DNA as they go through here. And the nice thing about these segments is that you can control exactly A, C, G, you can control the bases as you go down on these DNA strands. And then you collect these segments, you multiply them, you sequence them, and you can reconstruct the path the gold took, which allows you to reconstruct the track the WIMP took. Which means, and if I look towards the WIMP wind, I should expect 10 times as many this way as this way, and so you can look for that kind of directionality. So that's kind of a fun idea that that we had. I'm going to skip some other fun ideas that we have because we're writing proposals to Homeland Security, and I'm actually serious about that. But anyway, so I don't know how long I should go, so Stefan, where are you? All right. Well, so there's the third prong of WIMP detection, which is, we call it indirect detection. So I talked about the fact that if they're their own antiparticles, whenever they collide, they annihilate, which doesn't mean that just they go off in Neverland. It means they turn into something else. So this annihilation process could lead to a chain. And at the end of the chain, one of the things you would get at would be gamma rays. These are high energy photons, particles of light. So where would this annihilation happen? Well, I already talked about it happening in the early universe where things are very tightly packed. But it also could happen in today's universe in areas that have a lot of WIMPs. So that could include the center of the galaxy. It could include dwarf galaxies, which are in our neighborhood. And so you look in the right direction and you might be able to see some of this annihilation. Okay, so you look I mentioned the gamma rays, but you could also look for positrons or neutrinos. You could look for a lot of different annihilation products, and it's all being done. But the gamma rays, the reason I'm focusing on that is because there is something interesting that people have seen. So here's this Fermi satellite that is up there, and it's looking at the gamma ray sky. Again, the gamma rays are high-energy photons, particles of light. So this is the gamma ray sky seen by the Fermi satellite. And Savas Kousiapas here at Brown has been studying, in particular, the dwarf galaxies. But I'm going to focus instead on towards the center of the galaxy, these two big lobes. So these are this bubble, the Fermi bubble. And most of that is understood, but there's a central spherical part that could be gamma rays that came from dark matter annihilation. You do expect a lot of dark matter near the center of the galaxy, so that's a possible explanation. But recently it's also become clear that dark matter is one explanation, but there's a simpler one. It could be rapidly spinning neutron stars. There are other explanations for it. So maybe this is not dark matter. But if it is, it actually could be compatible with the Dhamma signal. It could be the same kind of particle. So we don't know exactly what's going on there. So we do have some possible evidence, both from these underground experiments and from these gamma ray detectors. And theorists are trying to understand what's going on. Why does Dhamma see something? Why does Lux not see anything? What's going on at the galactic center? Trying to put all these pieces together. As my friend Frank Halliprice says, there's always one explanation compatible with everything. It's all background. It's all just noise. We'll see. So what we do need is compatible signals in a variety of experiments made of different materials and all the parties agreeing. So that's the goal. I did want to mention, just in one slide, my latest, I don't know what to call it, my latest baby, I really like this. There's dark stars. This is another place where dark matter annihilation can be important. It can power the very first stars that formed in the universe. So, bombed out in space, with a spaced out bomb. Anyway, so that movie, I didn't know about this movie until after we wrote our paper. But so the three of us, Doug Spoliar, Paolo Gondola, and I had the idea for this. And the basic idea is that when the first stars formed, that's when the universe was about 200 million years old, they formed in these kinds of protogalactic objects, and they formed smack in the middle. So unlike the sun, which is not at the center of the galaxy, if you're right in the middle of these objects, you have a lot of dark matter, and you would have enough dark matter for a lot of annihilation. And as you have a collapsing cloud of hydrogen, it could be powered by dark matter. So I did want to say that the dark matter constitutes less than actually one part in a thousand of the mass of the star. So it's really it's an object made of hydrogen, but it's powered by dark matter. It's possible that these objects can grow to be very large, even a million times as massive as the sun or a billion times as bright. And if that's true, then my deepest wish is that they're going to be discovered in the James Webb Space Telescope, which launches in 2018, and it's the sequel to the Hubble Space Telescope. Then once the dark matter runs out in these things, then eventually they'll collapse to black holes, and that could be an explanation for the many large black holes seen in the universe that are very, very, very hard to explain. So perhaps they're the origin of supermassive black holes. So so we have many different directions of looking for these particles, and we'll see what happens, and we're hoping to resolve this dark matter problem. Now you still have in this pie chart this big 70% dark energy, and I don't have a lot to say about that. I am going to say that it's very, very difficult both experimentally and observationally. Both theoretically and observationally. So theoretically, the simplest explanation would be something called the cosmological constant, again proposed by Einstein, but for very different reasons. And this is a kind of vacuum energy. And indeed, in this room, you have particle-antiparticle pairs being produced that last very, very short time, and then they disappear again. And that's what we mean by the vacuum. And that's actually measured. It happens. And if you get exactly the right amount of that happening throughout the universe, that would be an explanation for the dark energy. But unfortunately, if you did the math and you make the predictions, you're off by 10 to the 120, the 120 in the exponent. Okay, so we really don't know what is going on. So that would be constant in time. But one of the things that would be more interesting is if it changed in time. There's a lot of ideas, theoretical ideas for that. And that, on the observational side, we will be trying to test with many, many upcoming observations. So that's what's going on in the near future for that, in the next 10 years or so. So as I said, I'm not going to talk much about it. I'm going to end instead with a joke. So I was on a panel in the World Science Festival in 2011, and the three of us, this is me, Eleanor Aprile, the leader of the Xenon experiment, and Glenys Ferrar at NYU, we were talking about dark matter in this panel. And here we have Mike Turner, Saul Perlmutter, who won the Nobel Prize for the discovery of dark energy, and Brian Greene, who's one of the great science writers. And so they were talking about, so we were doing dark matter, they were doing dark energy, and I made the following true statement. Because that's about all we know about dark energy. Dark energy is causing the universe to accelerate, so it is something repulsive in that sense. So I meant to say that before I put this up, but anyway. So on that note, I'll conclude and take questions.
So we're just a few comments. First of all, none of this would have been possible without the hard work behind the scenes by this man right here, Pete. Thank you, Pete. It's really interesting, but I won't get into that. But time for a few questions, please. Yes, you gentlemen back. Speak loudly, by the way, or come up to the mic.
You're going to have to come up to the mic. I can't hear a word.
A number of the methods you discussed of detecting WIMPs piggybacked off neutrino detection. How would you screen out the neutrino noise that you would get by using the same methods?
Oh, so you're talking about in the South Pole?
Right.
The detectors?
Yeah.
So the one neutrino, this is called the Ice Cube Deep Core experiment. What they have seen are very high energy neutrinos. That is, it's very interesting, but it has nothing to do with dark matter. So neutrinos are, so the energies and the behavior of the particles are going to be, okay. So when you're looking for neutrinos from annihilation, that's a different thing than when you're looking for the scattering of particles off of these crystals. And so this was already something realized by Drucki and Sadalsky, that neutrino elastic scattering is even harder to detect than the WIMPs. WIMPs are more massive, they deliver more energy. But I didn't show this, but we're about to actually hit what's called the neutrino floor. So as these experiments get more and more sensitive, you are going to have trouble disentangling neutrinos from the WIMPs. And the way to do it is to use the fact that you've got the different energy behavior. And if you're lucky, if you have directionality, then you'll be able to do it that way. So in the future, this will be a problem. Right now, it's not.
Okay.
That's a little longer answer than you wanted, probably, but. Chris.
Why would the WIMP wind in one direction? We're talking about it.
So the WIMPs are moving every which way. Okay.
But
we are moving in one particular direction. So the sun is moving around the center of the galaxy, okay? So I'm going with the sun. So we're creating the wind. Just like when you're driving, you're creating the raindrop, the effective raindrops coming at you.
So you mentioned that dark matter could be either matches or WIMPs, but there is the third option that dark matter could possibly be explained by modification of gravity.
Yes.
What is the current status of those?
Yes. So there's I actually meant to say something about that. So there's an idea that was originally called MOND, Modified Newtonian Dynamics. And you can explain these rotation curves of galaxies without dark matter if you modify Newton's laws. When you get far out in the galaxy, then where the acceleration is lower, then Newton's laws would be different. So that actually, it was a model that matched the data for that particular type of experiment. But it was just sort of a hand-waving model. And then people have written down a more rigorous version, which is called TEVIS, which has all kinds of new ingredients. In addition to the Einstein's theory, you add additional elements. And once you have that, then you can start actually making predictions and comparing to data. And so first of all, let me point out, you've already added a lot of other stuff instead of the dark matter, so you're adding things. But also, the comparison with observation doesn't work too well. In particular, the microwave background is really problematic. And if you try to tweak that to work, then large scale structure goes wrong. And they thought they could do it by adding, you can still, if you add in, guess what? New types of matter. So even with all the tweaking in the world, it just isn't working very well.
So you're obviously incredibly successful. And as a young grad student just starting out, do you have any advice for young women getting started in their science careers?
If I'm hesitating, because I was just meeting with undergraduate students, we're just talking about exactly these kinds of questions. So one thing that's very important is having a supportive, powerful advisor, somebody who can help you with your career. So that's phenomenally important. And another thing is that it's very easy to convince yourself that, oh, I'm not that good, everybody else is better, da 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 da. And guess what? We all experience that. And if you're passionate, and then keep going. Follow your passions, follow your dreams. So I guess those would be the first two things that come to mind.
No questions from the geniuses in the
room? Not allowed. Okay. Not allowed. Zip it. Zip it. Zip it. I'm kidding. I'm kidding. Now go ahead. Go ahead.
So I wanted to just one more point. Now, when you talk about the bullet galaxy, the behavior of the halos as the two galaxies apart, you argue that essentially what we would call mean-free paths are very large, and so they and yet, when you talk about the role of dark matter in the early stages of the universe, you do want this company. In particular, in your dark star models, you want company. There's a slight tension there. Can you accept that?
No, in dark stars, I'm not doing any clumping. It's in every galaxy or previous smaller object, there's a lot of dark matter in the middle. It's just there because it's. So we're not adding anything more into that. In the dark stars, as the hydrogen cloud starts to collapse, it gravitationally pulls in some more dark matter. But actually, in the dark stars, it's the hydrogen that dominates the mass. So they're just following along. And so I deflected your real question very successfully, I would say. So we'll just, so we'll be able to.
We'll talk about that. One more question?
You're right next to the microphone. Please use it.
Sure. My question would be, you said that dark energy could be contributed by the Einstein's cosmological constant, right? And my question would be, is that constant positive or negative?
Positive.
Positive?
Yeah.
Sure?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, you're allowed to ask a question with a yes or no answer. Yeah, I'm just kidding.
Okay, then let's thank the speaker.